Okay. I want to thank everyone for tuning in January 2nd to KDNK and another edition of Weight Off Your Shoulders. In my studio, I've got Dr. Adam Holen, doctor of chiropractic care, and he's got interesting ways of looking at where he wants to emphasize care. And, you know, not all chiropractors do exactly the same thing in the same way that doctors have their specializations and they get their board certifications for this, that, or something else, whatever that might be. And the same thing is true within the field of chiropractic care. I know that in the deep past, it was very doctrinaire. You were on that lane, and that's what you had to do. And it was almost, I don't know, sacrilege if you did something else outside of that. But I think things are changing because the idea of integrative care and, you know, who knows what you might want or need, you know, traditional Western medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, traditional Chinese medicine, herbology. There's a million things out there, massage, to consider. And this is one of those things. Dr. Adam Holen is in the studio right now. Adam, if you don't mind, I call you Adam.
Yeah, that's fine.
Fantastic. Welcome to KDNK Studios and Weight Off Your Shoulders.
Thanks for having me in. Appreciate it.
So, all right. Yeah, what I wanted to do is just ask you, what drew you to chiropractic care?
Growing up, I played sports all the time as a kid and had a few injuries here and there and sought chiropractic care for it because none of them were bad enough for, you know, surgery or anything like that. So got into it, especially in high school, and I was kind of fortunate enough that going through school, high school, college, and even grad school, I knew what I wanted to do. But it wasn't until grad school that I realized I wasn't going to be doing the traditional chiropractic stuff. So it all made sense to me from the get-go. But kind of what happened in grad school was that I developed into a natural skeptic, and I liked the idea of better predictability in terms of outcome with a patient. So from there, I was introduced to integrative diagnosis, which is the system that I do, and it focuses on restoring healthy range of motion to joints by finding and fixing scar tissue.
Okay. So you wanted some connection to causality, and then from causality, you then would step forward into the idea of statistical probabilities in terms of outcomes.
Yep.
And so when you did a, you know, an analysis of the different types of modalities that you are probably using, you probably found some things that were, well, gee, you know what, this really does work pretty well. I'm kind of shocked and I'm really kind of disappointed in this other thing, you know? I mean, but you don't know until you try.
Yep. Yeah, very true. And especially in the chiropractic realm, a lot of what you get is, what did the person that introduced you to chiropractic do? And a lot of times it's just going off of, okay, they did that on me and it seemed to work and this or that, or what club was convenient when you're going through school. Whereas what I kind of found was that the modalities that seemed to work were the ones that kind of came up to the top the most. And when it comes to, is a bone out of alignment, even before I got into school, I'm like, well, why would it keep going out of alignment? Why would it keep getting pulled? So then I started thinking about, you know, the soft tissue stuff and how that might help. And, you know, we intuitively stretch and rub things that hurt, you know, so it's kind of the next level, the next generation of that. So, I did as much as I could at least investigate different modalities to, you know, not latch onto one thing right away. Because again, being a natural skeptic, I'm used to, okay, let's see the evidence first. Let's see what can happen with this. And if it doesn't pan out, try the next thing. And in the chiropractic realm, there's not a lot of that. A lot of people are more, this is what I've done. And kind of like you alluded to at the beginning of the show, it was almost sacrilege to do anything besides adjust people. And it's obviously evolved from that quite a bit. There are still straights and mixers, as they call them. So the straights are the ones that just adjust purely. And there's 100 a couple hundred different flavors of that on how to pop a joint. And then the mixer would be anyone that does adjust with, you know, heat, ice, e-stem, stretching, strengthening, all that stuff mixed in. And I just kind of found that it's better to focus on one thing and get really, really good at that in finding and fixing scar tissue.
So in a sense, you know, you're taking a look at things like the fascia, the cartilage, the ligaments and tendons, and then the actual muscle bodies themselves and seeing what's going on there, whether there's issues with blood vessels, you know, not, or blood flow restriction that might cause, you know, stickiness in the muscular fibers without getting into the actin myosin deal here. You probably saw those things and then realize, okay, how can I be utilitarian about this? What works? Okay. And so now you are now focusing on the joints and articulations specifically. Now, is there any difference in the way that you would treat, say, a ball and socket joint with a hinge joint? Or do you just look at it, well, it's a synovial joint, you know, what the heck, you know, just go from there?
Great question. It depends, but it does definitely change the dynamic. And what you look at is what's the most important part of this. So to kind of circle this back to everything, what it boiled down to is what's the primary job of the body, of the musculoskeletal system anyway, and that's movement. You know, first and foremost, our bodies move us around. Muscles turn into tendons attached to bones, and that's how we get locomotion. So when that starts to diminish, that's where you should look first. You know, to go to a stability case or, you know, strength case right away, you're negating the most important information that the body gives you. So in terms of a hinge joint, a ball and socket joint, obviously that changes the dynamic of the ranges of motion, because your shoulder, for example, is the most mobile joint in the entire body. It can abduct, it can flex, it can extend, it can do all this stuff. Whereas,
and spin.
And spin, yep.
Circumduction.
Yep. So the elbow or the knee especially, is essentially a hinge joint. It just flexes and extends. It flexes a lot more than it extends. So your primary focus on that, can it fully flex? And obviously fully isn't a great word because everyone's variable, but for the most part, it should be able to come up and touch your butt. You know, you should be able to bring your heel to your butt. Your shoulders should be able to come up and touch your head. If you can't do a simple, fundamental, functional, basic range of motion, you have a problem whether or not you know about it yet. And if you have pain, you obviously know about it. But the confusion in healthcare comes where people have these non-surgical issues and they don't know what to do about it. You know, there's all these different flavors of e-stem, stretching, PT, just everything that everyone wants to do. It can be super confusing. And kind of why, you know, we talked about coming on the show was to discuss, it doesn't have to be that complicated. First and foremost, can your body do its number one job? I mean, your eyes look, your ears listen, your nose smells. It shouldn't get too much more complicated than that, at least from the get-go.
Well, I'm hoping my brain thinks, but
yeah, unless you're taking a test or falling in love, yeah.
Well, yeah, I'd say those things kind of freeze things over sometimes a bit.
Absolutely.
I do want to ask you something that maybe is a little different, but you know, one of the things I take a look at as a personal trainer is things like evolutionary biology. And and so when I go back, you know, at least for those who believe in evolutionary biology, when I go back, say, about 550, 650 million years to the Precambrian, Cambrian line, Ediacaran, one of the things that seems to be noticeable is that there were no skeletal masses. You might have had, you know, calcium deposits, and then because of the cardiovascular needs, you know, calcium being needed for that, that is actually, to me, I think is probably one of the fundamental reasons why people today and other animals, you know, I mean, you know, get things like osteoarthritis, because the cardiovascular system is robbing the skeletal system to make sure there's enough calcium ions to allow the heart to continue to pump. Mm-hmm. And so, starting from there, is there anything that you would be able to recommend to patients or people like, hey, well, you know, think of getting osteoarthritis. What can I do about it?
Very deep, and I like that a lot. If osteoarthritis is just the most common one across the body from head to toe, and that's obviously multifactorial, but in general, it's coined the wear and tear arthritis because your joint just cannot handle the load that you're putting on it. And the crazy thing is that there's two spectrums that you can get osteoarthritis from doing nothing, from just being a couch potato your entire life. The other end of that spectrum is doing way too much. You know, your weekend warriors that are out there skiing, biking, crossfitting, all that stuff. It's just like exercise. It's on a bell curve where not enough isn't going to be good because you're not pumping blood through those tissues, through the cartilage, and it's wearing down, or you're doing too much and you're not recovering well enough and your body can't keep up with that. So it's a little bit of a trade-off, but for people that are doing that, the general recommendation that I would make is look at what your activity level is. If you think you're getting osteoarthritis or you happen to get an x-ray for something that's recently come up, if you're super sedentary, I would recommend getting in touch with someone like you and getting off the couch a little bit more. If you've been dealing with something, osteoarthritis, and you're on the other end of that spectrum, I would think about starting to make some healthier longevity choices in terms of yoga and stuff. That's just, you know, you're still getting a little bit of a workout, but you don't have to be beating yourself up from head to toe every single day, you know? So osteoarthritis, that's a great one. But generally people don't know about it until it's a little bit late.
Yeah. That kind of, it is a cruddy situation to say the least. Yeah, I think that there definitely is, a happy medium between what some of, well, we won't go 600 million years, but let's just take it back, say, 100,000 years, maybe 300,000 years to the divergence between Neanderthalensis and sapiens and Denisovans. And some of those people show that they had exceptional wear and tear, stress loads, bone breakages, and so forth. And then recently I came across a study of Neolithic women that are just coming out of the Stone Age, or they were still in the Stone Age, just pre-Bronze Age. And some of them were shown that they had stronger humerus bones than Olympic rowers. You know, people and crew. And so you're thinking, well, why did they not get osteoarthritis in their shoulders and elbows? And to me, that's something that begs for an answer.
Yeah. That one's a little bit out of my ballpark in terms of why they wouldn't get it. I mean, there's 100 different factors that you're dealing with back then in terms of nutrition, diet, what you're doing to survive. Just not get eaten back in those days, you know, make it procreate and get your seed onto the next generation is pretty much the idea. Why the difference would be, that's a great question, which I'm not the one that has to answer for that, but I would say it probably has something to do with how different life was on a daily basis. So you wake up not knowing if you're going to make it to tomorrow and where your next meal is coming from. So, I mean, that just changes the ball game in terms of stress response, cortisone in your system, and let alone the diet that you're getting, if you're even eating that day. So, I mean, that can change everything.
Yeah. My wife and I are committed to vegans, and, and I'm not sure if there's any good, longitudinal studies or linear studies that are, you know, with a narrow focus, but tracking people for a really long time or widespread type of a meta-analysis, a situation, checking out the relationship between diet, skeletal health, joint health, and so forth. And, you know, one thing I'm aware of is that, you know, the best hunters today with their guns don't always make a kill because the animals may not be there, in which case you are either a breatharian or you're a vegan.
Exactly.
And so I have a feeling that those folks were probably more inclined to, you know, to go after, Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse trying to eat their food rather than Jumbo the elephant or a mammoth.
Mm-hmm.
It would probably be a little easier. And they're probably eating a heck of a lot more in a way of plants. Out of necessity, they would have known their plant world far better than we do. It would not have been limited to maybe 50 different kinds of plants in a grocery store, but more like, you know, I don't know, 3,000-4,000 different kinds of plants that people would have been eating. So there could be missing nutrients there.
Oh, yeah, easily. When you have to know the land, life or death, I mean, think about our day-to-day. If you point out five plants and tell someone that one of them is going to kill them, no one's going to want to eat any of them. You know, it's too much of a risk, but that was the life that they lived back then. So their lives depended on knowing that stuff. And obviously there were the cases where people didn't make it because they were the ones that had to figure out the hard way that that's not edible and it's not going to jive with your system. So I completely agree. I mean, it essentially started off plant-based because killing an animal when you're in such a small tribe of, you know, basically your family and the people that you can trust, they didn't start hunting mammoths and becoming carnivores for hundreds if not thousands of years, because that took group coercion in order to get that. So we absolutely started off with the finer meats of whatever was scampering around the cave at that point and graduated to the unison of working with other people to, you know, go after the mammoths and stuff. And at that point, that's where I'd like to see a tick in the scale. If there was ever, if you could ever look at a study of, you know, the structure of people at that point, when you had that, that group thought of hunting together and surviving together and really starting to pick things up, because that's when diet would have really changed for people. And that's what I'd like to see, especially in the osteoarthritis part, where how that affected it.
Okay, now, and the reason why I brought this up was because this goes back to the idea of you know, integrating diet, exercise, and yes, recovery from your exercise or whatever it is you're doing, your work. You know, maybe you're out in the construction field and you're moving cinder blocks all day long, or you're digging a ditch, putting in fencing, or, you know, toting 8 2x4s. All day long on your one shoulder, probably, instead of switching. Mm-hmm. And now you get these asymmetries. And, you know, you as someone who played sports, you understand why it's important to have bilateral symmetry. And of course, the spinal column. Now, is there anything that you do to help people with, you know, things like their lower backs or any part of their back, their spinal columns and their joints? What kinds of treatments do you specifically go to? Say, for instance, muscle adhesion. It's like, hey, Adam, God, I mean, this muscle's so freaking tight. I mean, what am I going to do about this? This really sucks.
Yeah. There's a ton of different reasons for a muscle to be tight. So that's kind of where that thought process starts, is breaking down the mechanics of, it's not as simple as this muscle's tight, stretch it. This muscle's weak, strengthen it. You know, there's inherent reasons for a lot of this. So in terms of adhesion, that's what I focus on, because it just happens to be one of the most common problems that develop. And kind of what we discussed before was the overuse aspect of this valley. You know, you get people that are overusing their bodies constantly. And in this case, let's say the low back. So what I do in the office to look at that, someone comes in, they're like, I got a super tight low back, or I got low back pain or sciatica or whatever. The beautiful part about what I do is that it's about as objective as you can possibly get in terms of healthcare. So I never have a preconceived notion about what I'm going to do with a patient, because opinion doesn't matter in terms of what's wrong with someone. Your problem has an objective reason. How you feel about that, you know, pain, weakness, all that stuff, that's subjective. So what I do with someone with a low back is check, can their low back flex? And I actually put a pencil on their back and have them do like a cat cow or a cat mm-hmm. camel. Is it flexing? That's the most functional range of motion for the low back. If it can't do that, that's where we start. But we also put it into context, because the back isn't quite as straightforward as, say, the shoulder or the knee. So the back, you need to look at the hamstrings, the hips, and kind of the hip flexors, so your psoas and stuff like that. So it's putting everything into context and basically figuring out what's worse and what's not working, and then reverse engineering how that can relate to someone's history. Because when someone comes in, I have no idea what they're going to tell, what they're going to tell me. And I have no idea if I'm going to be able to help them. So I just sit there as an objective, quiet observer, listen to their story, because this is what they're, you know, telling me. Then we go into an objective functional exam. You know, can you move? Can your body handle load? You know, in some cases people move really well, but they can't handle load. They're weak. That, in that case, that's where you need strength and stuff. So, in terms of low back mechanics, the modalities that I use are basically my hands, and I have one instrument that looks like a credit card that helps me break down scar tissue. So for the low back, say their low back didn't flex, we'd go in there, and with treatment every visit until discharge, we're measuring that and making sure that it improved, because the only results that matter are the sustainable ones. So, I mean, there's 1,000+ things that you can do to someone, poke them, you know, sit on them, whatever, they're going to feel better, or at least different than when before that. So what I look at are the things that are tangible, measurable, and sustainable. So if I can get your low back flexing better because there's relevant scar tissue or adhesion in there, I break that down and fix that. A month later, your back is still flexing as good as it did on our last visit. That's a huge success. That's stable. And that's what healthcare should be about.
Okay. And all right. So, I guess one of the things I want to add, something else I want to ask too, is if someone is experiencing, you know, something along the lines of, like cartilage damage or ligament damage and things like that, where, you know, obviously the presence of blood is really damaging to that type of tissue. In fact, will, in a sense, liquefy it. And then that person is really in a bad jam. What kind of modality we got a couple minutes left, but
In terms of cartilage damage or joint degeneration or things like that, I can only help with what conservative care can help with. And it's also my job to let you know about those things. If you don't know about it, if you haven't seen it on imaging yet or an MRI, if I'm suspicious of that, I need to be able to diagnose that accurately. So I look at that as, okay, do you have limited range of motion and cartilage damage? Okay, I can help you with the limited range of motion to decompress the joint, get things moving around better, because in general, that cartilage damage is because something's getting beat up. You know, there's just, it's not moving right. So part of that, you know, it's not like the entire cartilage surface degenerates. It's gradual in certain spots, and as it wears down, it gets worse and worse. Kind of like when a tire's falling off a car, you know, or is going flat on a car, it just gets progressively worse.
Right.
So modality wise, it's the same across the board, but you have to respect reality. And I have to tell the patient, look, this is what you have. This is what I can help with. It may get X percent better. It may get 100% better, but these are the facts, because you're showing signs of it. Your history points to it, and we have it on imaging.
Okay. So it also sounds like there's, there's going to be issues with, obviously when you're taking, images, you know, you're going to use frontal plane and sagittal plane, so front to back and then sideways to take a look at the whole body and see if things are goofy. And I guess you'll probably also be taking a look at things so that, for instance, someone's doing squats, and the proper squat form requires you to drop down, and you got an acute angle of the knee, and I am sure that is probably not good for long-term health. I do want to ask you, so if we have more information, but I do need to find out, how do we get in touch with you, Adam?
I'm located in Glenwood Springs, in the Blue Roof Building. The website, so my business is called Avail Soft Tissue and Spine, AVAIL. You can find me on most social media outlets at Avail Soft Tissue, or info@AvailSoftTissue to email. Website, availsofttissue.com, and our phone number is 970-930-6255.
All right, fantastic. And I thank you so much for visiting us, and look forward to interviewing you again. And we're going to continue with our programming.
It.